Hello, my name is Erin Schaefer, and I'm a GA at the Women's Center, and I'd like to welcome you to our first Women on Wednesday series, Education, Advocacy, and Empowerment, celebrating 20 years. A couple of things before we get started. Please turn off any cell phones or pagers. Please remain in your seat until 12:50 as a courtesy to our speaker. And also, if you could fill out the orange evaluation sheet, we use this for future programming. Our presenter today is Linnea House, and she's the Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota, and former president of the NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota Foundation Board of Directors. She has worked in the reproductive health field for over 10 years, most recently with the Midwest Health Center for Women and Pro-Choice Resources. House has a bachelor's degree in English and Women's Studies from St. Olaf College and master's degree from nonprofit management from Hamline University. She lives in South Minneapolis with her partner and two young sons. Today's session is in commemoration of the 38th anniversary of the landmark Roe v. Wade decision legalizing abortion. Please join the Women's Center in welcoming Linnea House.
Thank you to everybody who's here today. It's a pleasure to be here in St. Cloud. Thank you to Erin and Jane and the Women's Center for inviting me. I just wanted to clarify that last Friday was the 37th. Anniversary of the Roe v. Wade, which is the Supreme Court decision that gave a woman's right to choose here in the United States. Again, my name is Linnea House. I'm the Executive Director at NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota. As you heard, I am the mom of two young boys. I live in South Minneapolis. I started working on reproductive rights actually when I was a student at St. Olaf College in 94. I was a student representative working on the campus as a part of NARAL, and I also was here at the St. Cloud campus about 20 years ago for band camp, so it's nice to be back. I can't believe it's been 20 years. In my day job at NARAL, I work to coordinate all of the programs that we do, which include doing student organizing. I also work directly with elected officials at the state capitol. I'm lobbying them and informing them about legislation that's coming up, either to promote pro-choice values or to fight against legislation that we believe will actually hurt women. And we also work to get pro-choice candidates elected. So we do a lot of work educating and working with our other partners to make sure that we have the elected officials in place to help us ensure that we can continue to protect a woman's right to choose. Today, I'm going to share with you some of our beliefs that we have at NARAL and touch a little bit about what's been happening at the federal level with healthcare reform as it pertains to abortion. I'll make sure that we have some time for questions at the end. I just ask that we all be respectful and thoughtful in our questions and hope that we can have an open dialogue. So with that, I'll begin. So I think I'm going to do a little bit of background information. I just want to let everybody know what we believe, what it means to be pro-choice. Can you still hear me? Great. So we believe the main point is that who decides? We believe that we need to trust women to make choices, to make the private medical choices without interference from the government. That is the right to privacy that was declared in the Roe v. Wade decision. We also believe that women need to have options. We need to have options that include not only having access to family planning, but that women have access to be able to have healthy pregnancies and have healthy outcomes when they do decide to carry their pregnancies to term, and that they also have options for adoption and also have options for abortion. So we believe that the whole healthcare range needs to be included. And we also believe in women's health, dignity, and equality. We believe that if a woman does have access to that broad range of reproductive health options, that'll ultimately improve a woman's life. And we know when women's lives are improved, their families' lives are improved, and the community's lives are improved. So we believe that there are actually a ripple effect in that way. So again, today's agenda, I'm going to do a little bit of background information about abortion realities in Minnesota, what's actually happening, some stats, information like that. Touch a little bit again on federal health care reform, what I think your next steps are, and then some questions. So today in Minnesota, there are currently 7 abortion clinic providers in Minnesota. 7. 6 of them are in the Twin Cities and 1 is in Duluth. So for women who are living in outstate Minnesota, and that would include St. Cloud, you need to drive somewhere to receive abortion services. If you live, there is one abortion provider in North Dakota, and that is in Fargo. There's one abortion provider in South Dakota, and that's in Sioux Falls. And the physicians that are actually performing in Duluth, North Dakota, and South Dakota are actually being flown in from the Twin Cities. So there are no actual physicians that live in those locations providing. So as a corollary, 95% of Minnesota counties have no abortion provider. We have mandatory and biased counseling requirements in the state of Minnesota, also known as the Women's Right to Know, which requires that a woman must hear state scripted information from a physician 24 hours before her procedure. There is information in there that's biased, talking about that a woman who has an abortion has a higher incidence of breast cancer, which has not proven to be true, and it adds an additional layer of access barrier for women, because oftentimes the clinics require the women to come to the clinic 2 days in a row so you can receive the information 24 hours in advance and you need to go back, which is a huge barrier if you don't live in the Twin Cities. We have an abortion gag rule, which basically means that there are certain organizations that if they receive state money to do family planning services, cannot talk or refer to abortion. Even if a woman directly asks if there are options, they cannot actually tell her. We have mandatory parental notification in the state of Minnesota. So if a woman is under the age of 18 and she is not yet emancipated, she needs to have the approval of both of her parents before she has a medical procedure. And there are ways where you can get a judicial bypass, where you actually have to go in front of a judge and tell them why you want to have the procedure and why you cannot tell your parents. But that is, again, one more barrier in the way. And in the state of Minnesota, you can refuse to provide medical services. We mostly see this in pharmacies, where a pharmacist can refuse to fill your birth control pills, they can refuse to fill your emergency contraception, and they can refuse to refer you to somebody who will. They have to give you the prescription back, but they are not required to actually fill that prescription. And what I did not list on here. So as an overall goal, our national organization, Narrow Pro-Choice America, does grading of states. And overall, Minnesota has a C+ when it comes to reproductive health care, primarily because of these bans that we have in the state of Minnesota. We have had a couple of victories recently. In 2007, we were able to pass the Compassionate Care for a Rape Victim or Sexual Violence Victims Act, or EC in the ER, which requires that all hospitals are required to offer a woman who has been a victim of sexual violence or rape access to emergency contraception. That moved us up from a C to a C+. And overall in the nation actually has a D. So we're slightly better than the nation when it comes to reproductive health care. So reproductive health realities. Without contraception, the average woman would get pregnant 12 to 15 times in her life. Effective family planning helps women space their pregnancies. Short intervals between births are associated with low birth weight and infant mortality. Taking away a woman's right to legal abortion will not actually decrease the number of abortions. It will return women to the back alleys, and women's health and lives will be endangered from unsafe procedures. A little unknown fact, so the country of Brazil, it is not legal to have an abortion. They have the exact same abortion rate as the United States, so the fact that it's illegal does not prevent women from having abortions. What it does is that there are higher mortality rates associated with it. The risk of death associated with childbirth is 10 times greater than the risk of death from an abortion. And legal abortion is safer than a tonsillectomy, an appendectomy, or a shot of penicillin. Almost half of all pregnancies in the United States are unintended, including more than 30% within marriage. I think that there's a lot of misperceptions about who's actually getting pregnant and why they choose to have abortions. And I think that the fact that almost half of all pregnancies are unintended reflects that there are a lot of women who are getting pregnant, and a lot of them are married and already have children, and they are still choosing to have abortion. Investing in family planning services saves money. Every government dollar spent on contraception saves, and actually this is a little outdated. It has $3. The information that we had from last year was that actually saves $6. So anytime you, and that's just within the first year of that investment. So it is far cheaper for us to make sure that women have access to contraception than not. It actually costs the state quite a bit. So our priorities, which is why I have that little background for you, we believe that women need to have, and men need to have, better and more access to contraception. 87% of Americans support access to birth control. And we are expecting, I don't know if you've all heard, but there's a budget crisis that's happening in the state of Minnesota. We are expecting that there are going to be cuts to programs that provide family planning services in the state of Minnesota, which will be a pity, I think. We've been working for at least 10 years on passing a responsible sexuality education, requiring our young adults to hear about comprehensive sex ed. The latest polls, 89% of parents in the state of Minnesota want this. Most of them, I think it's actually happening, and we know that it's not. And this just came out yesterday. There are new reports saying that actually unintended pregnancy rates, STIs, and HIV rates are skyrocketing, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that we've been having abstinence-only education. And the numbers that we just got out are from 2006. And so I have a feeling that we're going to continue to see an increase. Contraceptive equality. There are health insurance companies that do not cover the cost of contraception. And as we all know, the state of Minnesota actually has a law that says that you cannot charge more for health insurance costs for men than women. But nationwide, that is not actually a requirement. It's something that's in the larger bill, but whether that'll actually happen. So basically what that means is, as a young woman, you will probably pay anywhere between 25 to 50% more for your health insurance than a young man. And we believe in access to abortion. We believe, and we have, our studies show that people overwhelmingly believe that individuals need all the information that they can, and that when they have that information, they support women actually being able to make the decisions for themselves. So the federal health care debate, what is the current state of abortion care in the effort to reform health care? Before I move on, are there any questions? Does anybody want to ask, or do you want to save till the end? I'm easy. All right. Oh, sorry, go ahead. So I think what I hear you saying is that you're surprised at how few locations actually provide abortions. I think that that's a really important thing for people to understand. I think when we go and talk with students or when we talk with elected officials, they seem to think that every major city has access to abortion care, that your private physician can do that. There are so many requirements that are that have been added on, we call them trap laws, that make it really hard, and you have to have a system in place to provide procedures. So yeah, I mean, it's going to continue to dwindle. I know as little as 5 years ago nationwide, the actual number of abortion providers is actually decreasing. And so it's the access for women who live in rural areas is actually become more and more stark. Yes.
Can you ask the audience how many of them got comprehensive sex ed?
Oh, I'd love to hear.
High school and/or abstinence only.
So we've been asked to see if people would be willing to share by a raise of hands whether they got comprehensive sex education or abstinence only. And we've done things in the past where we've asked for stories. We call them the good, the bad, the ugly stories about comprehensive sex ed that we share with legislators. So it's always fun to hear. So if people want to raise their hands, if you're comfortable, do you feel like you had comprehensive sex ed in your school? And how many of you had abstinence-only education in your school? And how many of you had nothing? One? Two? All right. I think it's important. I know that the comprehensive sex ed piece is really important to us because we want to make sure that the young people have all the tools. So we're not just talking about how do you know how to use a condom, what do you know STIs are, but we also want to make sure that young people have the tools to have healthy relationships. We want to make sure that people know what is appropriate in a relationship or not, you know, whether we can also tie it back to we work a lot with this organization called MnCASA, which is for sexual assault victims. So making sure that we are reaching our youth when we can to talk about healthy relationships and what that means. So it's just beyond sort of the birds and the bees talk. There's a little bit more to it. Yes. I think that's an important part when talking about mandatory requirements, and I think it goes back to the right to privacy. I think that we need to make sure that, so the example that you're giving was that these young girls were getting pregnant by their father, and if you're underage and then you have to have your father's consent to have a procedure, oftentimes that's not going to be possible. And it goes back to why we have to make decisions not for what we want to have happen in our home, but we have to be thinking about the society as a whole, because we don't know, quite honestly, what's happening in other people's lives. And I got to tell you, I can make decisions for myself and for my family, and I wouldn't want anybody else telling me how to raise my children. I wouldn't want somebody else telling me where my kids need to go to school, what to feed them. I think that there's a lot of things that when it comes to abortion rights that people feel okay inserting themselves into that decision. Yes. Yep, so if you can produce documentation, so you can do a number of things. If you don't live with your father, you've never had contact with your father, you can produce documentation that says as much, or you can do a judicial bypass where you actually have to go in front of a judge and disclose the reasons why you are not presenting them with the signatures of both of your parents. So, yes, if that was the way it was going to go, that would be an option for that young person. Should I move forward with the healthcare debate, which may not be going anywhere? So as of right now, I don't know if all of you have been following this. I do, and it makes me a little crazy because I don't even know what's going on. Currently, there are two bills, and I see it as two compromises on women's right to choose. In the House version of the healthcare bill, there is an overall public option so that the government would set up an exchange for people to go in and purchase publicly subsidized healthcare. However, in that House version, there was an amendment put forth by Bart Stupak, a Democrat from Michigan, called the Stupak Amendment. And this DUPAC amendment basically says that there would be no one who has any sort of public option health care can have access to abortion. That even if they pay with all of their own money for their health insurance, even if it's not subsidized by the government in any way, shape, or form, it cannot be used to pay for their abortions. In the Senate version, the overall bill, there is no public option. What is out there is called a health exchange. And Ben Nelson, a Democrat from Nebraska, was able to get the Nelson Amendment put on. And the Nelson Amendment says, yes, of course, okay, I don't agree with abortion, but you can have abortions. However, you have to declare ahead of time that you want to have abortion coverage in your health care. And you have to cut two different checks for your health care every single month. So a part that goes for the overall health care and a part that goes for abortion. So whether you actually ever need an abortion or not, you as women need to figure out what you're going to do. So you could be writing a check for $29 and $1 every single time you have to pay for your health care. And so those are the two versions that we have right now. And neither one of them are actually very good. I'm not exactly sure what is actually going to happen with the overall health care reform now that we've had a shift in balance in the Senate. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I think that originally there was hope that they would be able to get one of these versions passed out, and I got to tell you right now, I don't know what's actually going to happen. So I don't know if this is sort of all going to be wiped and we're going to start from scratch, but I have a feeling that regardless of what happens, at some point in time in this whole healthcare reform debate, it's going to come down to a woman's right to choose and restricting that in some way, shape, or form, which I think is a surprise to a lot of people who think we have a pro-choice president, and we have Democratic majorities in both the House and the Senate. And what we've always been saying as a nonpartisan organization, that Democrat does not equal pro-choice. And this is sort of the classic example of that, that it's been sort of railroaded, that the entire, and I find it a pity that the entire health care reform debate could be brought down by one procedure. So that's sort of my little 2 cents worth. Are there any other questions about federal health care? I guess I know we're talking about sort of on the edge, I think was in my title. And I think so for 37 years we've had the right to choose, and for 37 years we have been defending that right. And I think what I've been talking a lot with some of my founding mothers and founding fathers who were there when Roe passed, and they thought, yay, they thought their job was done, and now what we've been doing is defending that right ever since. And as a pro-choice advocate, I feel like so much of my time is spent defending away the small little chipping away at access to abortion and access to rights. And I think that 37 years later, I feel even more tenuous than I have even 10 years ago. And as much as I hate to say it, I think that we're going to be fighting this battle for a lot longer. Like I said, I'm a fast talker. And I have at least 15 minutes for questions, if people have questions or comments, or if you want to open it up to anything larger. Yes. I think you.
Okay.
Sorry, Jane.
Does anyone use the word terrorism? because it's strategic and it's ongoing and it's a pattern.
Yep. So Jane was asking me about the murder of Dr. Tiller last May. And it's really, I'm sorry, I'm getting really emotional because I knew him. And his motto was trust women. He really believed in the integrity of women to be able to make the decisions for themselves. And he was one of the few providers in the country that performed procedures for women who later in their pregnancies, who oftentimes had fetal anomalies and defects that if they were not able to have the procedure would either affect their ability to have children later in life or would actually endanger their lives to continue the pregnancy. So he was one of the few people who stood up to ensure that women have that right. There are lots of states that have restrictions about how far a procedure can be done in the state. And so he was one of the few physicians that was actually a savior to a lot of women and their families. He was in his church, and a gentleman came into his church and shot him while he was in a church service. And it was the first act of violence against an abortion provider since the end of the Clinton era. So the entire time that George W. Bush was in power, there were no actual assassination attempts on any physicians. In the late 90s, there were actually clinic bombings and assassinations of physicians. And that leads directly into the reason why there are so few abortion providers, for one, because physicians are scared to be a provider. Two, they're often stigmatized within the medical community itself. They're sort of seen as a subsection of OBGYN services, and while the physicians are often very happy to refer someone to a physician who provides abortions, they oftentimes don't want to be the one that does it, even if they have the skills and they see the need for it. We manage, we help one of our abortion providers in the Twin Cities with escorting. We have volunteer escorts that go in on Saturday mornings and make sure that the women who are coming in for procedures are free from harassment from sidewalk counselors or protesters. And since the election of President Obama, we have actually seen an increase in aggression, and we have seen more people coming in with knives. We've seen people coming in with guns. And we are quite nervous about the safety of our volunteers, but also of our clinic workers. I think that there is... a real threat, I think, to not just the right to choose, but I think to those who are advocating for that. And I think that I know my family is often scared for the work that I do, and I say I'm okay. I'm at the Capitol, sort of doing my thing. It's no big deal. But I really honor and respect the people who are on the front lines, actually providing procedures. So the question is why after Obama was elected? I think that there was, and I can't speak for people who I don't know, but my feeling is that the anti-choice movement felt that they had a champion in President Bush, and they felt like they were going to be able to get a lot of their agendas passed. And with the election of President Obama, that their issue was going to be eroded, and that there was a lot of frustration and a lot of fear, and that they felt emboldened to do something at this time. And I'm not saying that all anti-choice people believe in the advocating for violence against physicians, but there is definitely a subsect of people who do that type of work. In the 90s, there were, I can't remember the name of the website, but there was a website that had listed all of the names of abortion providers in the United States, and after one would be assassinated, they would cross off the name and say, one down. And so, this was, I'm sure we'll see something like that again in the future. Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is about the billboards and the billboard people and the messages they have about murdering their babies. I think that everybody, there is no conclusive scientific proof of when life actually begins. I think that, and there's a whole host and a whole range of religious views about when life begins. I think that what is happening is that one particular view is being pushed forth, and they have a lot of money, and so they're able to get that message out. And I think that, again, I really truly believe that everybody has the right to their own opinions, but I know that we often saw, when I was working at the clinic, a lot of pro-life people coming in and having procedures and saying, "This is only, but I am the one special exception as to why I need to have this procedure today," and then being back out the next week and being protesters again. I mean, and it happens, but I think that also rings true for me. Not that I deny them the right, because I got to tell you, I'm fighting for their rights too. Whether they agree with me or not, I'm always going to be fighting for their right to choose. But I think that it echoes back to why I think the right to privacy and why we have to be able to make sure that people can make decisions for themselves is so vitally important. Anybody in the back? Sure. Yes, that's a really good point. So the question was about generational support of reproductive rights. And I think that we do actually see, research has shown that we've been doing at the national level, that a lot of young women and men have a feeling that their right to choose is sort of taken care of, and that it's something that they don't really need to be very concerned about continuing to fight for those rights. And that's why the work that we're doing on campuses and work, me coming here today to talk a little bit about what's happening, is to make sure that people continue to understand that you could be denied your access to birth control. And I think that's a reproductive justice issue, that the status quo will not always be there, and that I think that we're doing a better job of engaging young people. I think that we're slowly catching up to making sure that we're on Facebook and that we're out where people are, and really trying to make sure that our message is resonating with them so that they understand that their right to choose could go away someday and how that would actually impact them. And I can talk a little bit about crisis pregnancy centers, or CPCs. I know you probably have one here on campus or nearby. So crisis pregnancy centers are organizations that often they provide services to women. They'll provide you with free pregnancy testing, and they'll generally try to dissuade you from having an abortion or even considering an abortion. And again, I think everybody has the right to choose to make their own decision about what to happen in your life. My issue with crisis pregnancy centers is that they will often use deceptive practices, luring people in and not actually telling you straight up that they have an agenda. They will oftentimes also give you misinformation about contraception and the efficacy of contraception, and also give misinformation about emergency contraception, medical abortion, and surgical abortions. And in the state of Minnesota, there was a law passed by Governor Pawlenty in 2005, I believe, called the Positive Alternative Grant Program. And this is basically state funding for organizations that provide positive alternatives to abortion. And so the majority of the money, I'd say 92% of that money, goes to crisis pregnancy centers. And for me, the issue is, I don't want my state providing funding for an organization that has a obvious religious slant, who may be providing inaccurate medical information, and who may also not be in compliance with HIPAA privacy laws. So that's something else that we are looking at and aware of. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that they have their organizations are set up in such a way that it's either volunteer-based medical information. So, you know, if they could actually be sued, I guess that is a possibility, whether I've never actually seen it happen. And what's been happening in other states right now is that some cities and some counties are working to put require that CPCs put up signs that say, we do not refer or perform abortions, and we do not, or some sort of language that basically lays out right away sort of what kind of services are actually provided there. Whether that's something we can do in Minnesota, I don't know. But there are organizations that do get the positive alternatives funding that do really good work with it, and I don't want to say that it's not a good program. I just want to make sure that the organizations that do get it are doing the best good with our government money. Yes. Who? That's a great question. I've been trying to find out who does actually the review and the grant who does the review and the approval of the grants. It's not something that I've been able to figure out, and I'm trying to work with some of our legislators to see if they can find out that information for us. It should be. What you can see who has received the funding and how much they received, and you can get a little bit of data about what services they are providing. And I haven't done a whole host of research on it, but I do know that the information that, let's say, the Converse program would be the Family Planning Special Projects, so FPSP, which is all your family planning products. And the organizations that get that, like, their information is very detailed. So you're able to actually get more data about who's doing that work, and so I would like to see, if nothing else, than a reporting compliance that's being reported back so that we can find out exactly what is being done with our state funding. It's about $5 million per biennium, or $2.5 million a year. Yes, in the back.
Do you experience resistance from your
friends or
family?
Do I experience resistance? You know, no. I have some people who I may not always talk about the work that I do, and I respect that we all have different values and different things that we work on in our lives. What has actually happened and what my experience has been is that once people know what I do, people want to tell me their stories. Like, I have lots of detailed personal information from people that I probably shouldn't know, because they're so excited to meet somebody who shares their values and they feel like they can talk to and understand what's happening. So I get a lot of that, actually, more so that it's an honor that they feel okay to talk with me about either their own abortion stories or somebody in their family or access issues that they've had. That's been more my experience, is that it's been more they're finally really excited. And I've actually had one friend who grew up going to protests, whose mom was the head of the anti-choice organization down in Mankato, and she is one of my biggest allies and is at every pro-choice lobby day that we have. And so she's really, just through our conversations and the way we've been able to interact, sort of really become supportive of me and the work that I do. Yes. However, when she after the delivery of her second daughter, she was living in Germany at the time, and she had complications afterwards. And I was the person that she called, because I was the person who had the most information about sort of what happens after a pregnancy or a delivery doesn't go well. And so I became a real resource for her, and I think that is something that a lot of people often don't understand. Should I go to my... Go ahead.
One more question.
Yeah.
So I just read that Obama has zeroed out the budget for abstinence-only education on a federal level.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, it seems like a victory to me.
Yep. So starting with the Bush administration, I think even before that, there was the majority of the money that was coming down from the federal agency to support sex ed was an abstinence-only curricula, so that teachers were gagged by what they could actually talk about. So that you, if you were to talk about contraception, it would mostly be talking about their failure rates and actually what sort of protection that they could provide you. So in his latest budget rounds, President Obama has zeroed out abstinence only. He has put $116 million into pregnancy prevention money, which would be available to states to then continue to provide those services, but with more of a slant towards preventing unintended pregnancies. And so that it would just, the message would be shifted in such a way. And I just want to make clear that all of our comprehensive sexuality education, the first thing we say is abstinence first, because we always want to make sure that our young people are waiting as long as possible, because there are a whole host of positive outcomes. But if you do decide to become sexually active, these are the tools that you need to protect yourself. So there is more federal funding coming, and that's part of the reason that we want to make sure that we have a comprehensive sex ed mandate here in Minnesota, is so that we have better ability to get that federal funding and to make sure that we're actually doing the best thing that we can for our youth in Minnesota. Way in the back. Sure. How to be an activist. I guess the first thing, of course, we're sort of more of a political organization, and so my information might be a little slanted, but I think that the first thing you should do is you need to find out who your elected officials are, and you need to find out whether they support your pro-choice values. And if they do, you should tell them thank you, and if they don't, you should tell them why they should. And I think that it's really important for our elected officials, because remember, it may not feel like it, but they work for you, and they need to hear from you how you feel, and they need to be held accountable for their votes that they take. I think you should find out what organizations in your neighborhood are helping to provide the services that women need, and ask if they need a volunteer. I think that you should, if there are internships available, if you want to learn more, contact the organization. And I got to tell you, just like the state, organizations are facing a tough budget battle. If we have somebody who wants to come in and learn, we are more than happy to have people come in and take on a new project for us, or help us with our data entry, or just learn something about what's happening. I'll do my next steps then. Thank you for that nice segue. We are having a Pro-Choice Lobby Day, woo, on Thursday, March 4th. We will have students from all over the state come in and talk with their legislators. We usually have about 200 people. We bring you in. We train you on the topics. We train you how to talk with your legislators. We give you food. We have a big rally. And then you go and you actually sit down and have conversations. And this year's topic, our main focus, is going to be on comprehensive sex ed again. And it's a really nice opportunity, I think, for one, for people, the whole idea of what it means to lobby is sort of demystified a little bit, because you can go and it's a beautiful building. The Capitol is a gorgeous building, and it's your building. You should feel comfortable in those halls talking with people. You should be comfortable talking with your legislators. I think youth in particular, they hear your messages. They want to make sure that they are hearing from you and your input. Every one person that's there in live is generally representing 10 at home who aren't saying anything. So they need to make sure that they hear from you. So yes, find out who represents you. Also at the federal level. So who is representing you, whether it's Michelle Bachmann, whether it is Senators Klobuchar or Senators Franken, let them know who you are, where you live, and what you're fighting for. This is a kind of an odd one, but fill out your census forms in March. The census is going to be crucial for us to determine. It determines a whole host of information, but it'll help us determine how many people we have representing the state of Minnesota in our House. So we may lose one of our federal seats if we lose our population. It also helps determine how much money we get from the federal fund, from the federal government, in helping us implement some of our work. And the rule of thumb right now with the census forms is that you should fill out the census where you keep your toothbrush. So if a lot of you don't actually live in the state of Minnesota, or if your parents don't live in the state of Minnesota, but you live here now, you should fill out the census here now. Does that make sense? And it really, if you just do it right away, it's super easy. It's just like your name, your address, and that's pretty much it. And register to vote, yes. Yep, register to vote where you keep your toothbrush, or I say where you have your birth control filled. Wherever it is that you are consistently living most of your life, that's where you should do your registering to vote and voting in those elections, because maybe you'll move back home with your parents and maybe not, but the decisions that are being made now while you're here, you can have a big impact on. And then that way, if you vote for somebody, you can say, hey, I voted for you, and I'm advocating for this at Lobby Day. Volunteer for a local nonprofit, and follow the healthcare debate. I know it's complicated, but if you hear actions from NARAL or Planned Parenthood or any of the other organizations that you're passionate about say, contact your legislator now, do it. Because even if it feels like it's a simple little thing and it doesn't matter, it does. I have friends who work for elected officials, and they like to hear from everybody, and oftentimes the other side is organizing just as much, and so they need to make sure that they're hearing your voice too. So I'm going to just close with, I guess we're almost done, that we respect and value women's health and understand that safeguarding women's health is fundamental to the well-being and equality of women, as well as the well-being of women's families. And that's all I have. Thanks for coming.